I'm thinking that if it ever occurred to you, many of you here this morning may have wondered just what it is that the Board of Trustees does. How many people have heard the term policy governance? Show of hands? It's good. I'm happy to see that, but it's not everybody. Policy governance is the name of a model for how the board conducts the church's business. In a nutshell, it means that the board delegates the day-to-day management of the church to the executive team. At the moment, that team is headed up by Steve Eddington and includes Sherry Woolsey, Chris Parker, and Sandy Martin-Ajar Sextant. The day-to-day management includes working with most of church committees, planning for and spending most of the church's budget, coordinating the calendar and the use of our buildings. For the most part, that's not what the board does. Since the executive team handles most of the management, the board can spend its time in the very important task of thinking, discussing, and planning for the church's long-term direction and development. The board does its work by respectfully observing and analyzing the church we are, comparing it to what we have said that we want to be, and planning how we can close any gaps or make things better. There are statements we have adopted about the church's vision, mission, and goals that are posted on the church website if you would like to peruse them. The most basic one of these statements is on the front of your order of service. It's our vision. Let's read it together. Right on the cover. The Unitarian Universalist Church of Nashua, New Hampshire, will be a beacon of liberal religious thought and action whose members are committed to the search for truth and meaning, the acceptance of diversity, and the promotion of social justice within a supportive and caring community. Simple, but profound. This year, the board has been pretty busy with the details of our upcoming ministerial transition, including preparing for the hiring of an interim minister. But the board has felt that we need to keep on working towards the church's vision, especially during the next couple of years. To that end, the board has adopted three specific priorities for the church to focus on for the rest of this year and all of next year. You might have seen my article about this in the March newsletter, and if you want further details, I'd be happy to talk it over with you. Today's service is devoted to one of those three priorities, the adoption of an all-church social justice project. The Social Justice Committee had written an outline for a project that the board felt would be a good fit. It is titled Ending Hunger and Homelessness. I am proud that many people within this church are already working as individuals and in small groups within the church to address these issues. There are those of you who cook and serve meals at the soup kitchen and shelter, people who volunteer at Anne Marie House, and many folks who bring in donations of food and personal care products at holiday times and throughout the year, to name only some of the ongoing efforts. We also have devoted many thousands of outreach collection dollars to supporting the local organizations working to end hunger and homelessness in the Nashua area. You can take a look at the extra white sheet that is in your order of service to see what our outreach collections have done over the past 8 or 9 years. It's really quite impressive. Under our new all-church social justice project, we want to continue and to celebrate the existing work and volunteer efforts within the church and in the associated organizations within the community. And this is the most important part. We want to offer ways that everyone, including our children, can be involved. This includes educating ourselves as well as offering that education to people outside the church about the problems of hunger and homelessness, advocating as individuals and also in the name of the church for solutions, volunteering our time, and continuing to contribute money. Sad to say, hunger and homelessness in our community are not new problems, and we would be arrogant to say that the UU Church of Nashua is going to solve them once and for all within the next 18 months. The many experienced local organizations who work these issues day after day and year after year can use our help, however. Ultimately, I have faith. I have faith, and many other people more knowledgeably than I am agree, that the problems can be solved, and it is important to work toward that goal. We aren't setting out to reinvent any wheels. I want to be clear about that. The idea of this project is that we want to pitch in as a whole church, as well as individually, in all the ways that we can. This is a challenge to ourselves, from which we, and as individuals, and as a church together, will learn and grow. We'll get out more than we give. As long as anyone in our larger town or region is hungry or homeless, we are all diminished by that fact. So our project is to increase our church's involvement with the organizations in our area who are listed, by the way, on the pink sheet in your order of service, very, very nicely listed out, who are already working on these problems. And now to talk a little bit more about the problems themselves, I want to introduce Bob Keating, who actually was the primary author of the Ending Hunger and Homelessness Project outline. He's a board member of the Nashua Soup Kitchen and Shelter and has been working with them for 22 years. And in his professional life, he's a marriage and family therapist. So now, Bob.
Hello. I want to thank Alan Isher and the Board of Trustees on behalf of the Social Justice Committee and the Community Outreach Subcommittee for your support of this project, and really to the congregation from all of the groups that have benefited from our Sunday collections in many other ways. So I want to again extend a thanks to all of you from that. I was sitting through the service so far, and I felt from the song from Imagine and Sarah's reflections of trying to be declared homeless, and then the poem it Could Be Otherwise, and then to Hard Times, and thinking about that song and the author of that song, the writer of that song, dying in a charity ward, I felt like, well, that's sort of the story, and I don't know much more to be added after that in terms of at least deepening the picture that we all know about hard times in a variety of ways in our lives. I'm thinking that for a period of time here in our church, that we used to have the services that would be sponsored by one or more of the UU principals. Remember that, for some have been here. So I want to introduce a couple of them and say they're sponsoring this one. The first one is, number one, inherent worth and dignity of all human beings. Tough to go beyond that one. Everyone counts. There is no exceptions. There is no asterisk there. It is not about whether you are this or that or have that or this. You belong. The first one. The second one, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And the essence of the golden rule and Christianity, and in so many world religions, about that we are our brothers and sisters. That is the essence, and certainly in the humanistic traditions too. And the last principle, the interdependent web in which we are all a part. Again, we belong to each other. I love the song, you know, we are family, all my sisters and brothers and me. No, that's who we are. So this will be sponsored by our three principles and on our rich traditions of history, of caring for each other and the wider world. So let me focus specifically here on the issues of homelessness and hunger. by opening with a dialogue between two kids who were at the Nashua Soup Kitchen's main office on Chestnut Street. They were in the waiting area on the second floor, if you've been there. There were an 8-year-old, about, and a 9-year-old boy and girl. They were playing with little wobbly toys. And the little girl said in a serious voice, "Do you have a place to stay tonight?" And the little boy replies sadly, "No, I don't think so." She said, "You can stay with us. We have a big apartment." Speaking to his toy, the little boy says, "Can boys come too?" "Sure," she tells him. Lisa Christie, the executive director of the Nashua Soup Kitchen since its inception, reflects about that conversation. "We ask folks all the time, do they have a place to stay tonight? Grown-ups, adults, we ask. Where the family is sleeping, or if they have a place to sleep, is not something kids should have to worry about." It was heartbreaking and horrifying to hear these kids in their play speak so matter-of-factly about where they're sleeping. It was a stark reminder of the reality of the lives of many of the children we see in the soup kitchen and our shelters. It is a reminder that we have some serious changes in our society so that all of our children can grow up playing kid games as they deserve to. Reflecting this week, we had the honor of our youngest granddaughter taking care of her. And Hillary had her in her lap, and I was sitting on the couch, and Eller says, "Do adults play?" And Hillary, in her empathic response, she's a very playful woman, said, "Yeah, well, good." Because she really had a question about play. Well, here's Ella playing, and she wasn't worried about where she was going to sleep that night. So building from that story, I would suggest that the presence of homelessness in our society is like an indicator species, if you will. An indicator is one that points to the absence the lack of some kind of substance in our environment. In our backyard, we've been blessed with lady slippers, which indicate a certain kind of quality of acidity in the soil and fungus. On a less positive note, they can indicate the presence of noxious elements in the environment when you see this particular kind of species. Or in a closely related analogy is the canaries that were used in mines to indicate the toxicity of the air. And then I would suggest that the analogy fits for the presence of homelessness. They are the canaries of our society. They speak about the harshness of our social environment, of the toxicity of our environment. So that's the analogy from the natural world. Now, another sort of sketch that in this sort of lead-up is that there are reasons that most analysis of the reason for the kinds of numbers of homelessness that we have in our society are attributed to one major factor. There are many, but this is the central one. We cut $25 to $30 billion in housing-related services in the 70s. In the 70s, and particularly in through the 80s. Lo and behold, Nashua did not have a soup kitchen nor a shelter in any recent memory until 1982. And if you see nationwide, that's what starts to happen. The mushrooming of soup kitchens and shelters. Yes, there always was. I'm sure in almost every place you lived, you saw somebody in that way. Maybe some of you didn't see that at all. But the clearest thing is cutting housing subsidies, and we have not made up from that since. So, solutions. So I'm going to this really quickly on the solutions to give you that sort of frame. Well, there's a plan that was written in 2004 here in our community, a so-called Ending Homeless Plan, A Home for Everyone. And Miles Pendry, who was a longtime staff member of a Harbor Homes, as we were part of that group in writing it, looked up, and he had a very crisp way of kind of conceptualizing things. He said, "Oh yeah, I got it. Homelessness bad, housing good." Okay? So then he said, "Wait, there it is. There's your solution." And you know, oh yeah, okay, what does that mean? Well, in fact, it is not just the kernel of the truth, it is the essence of it. That we have repeatedly in this community and communities across the nation at an incredibly high success rate have been able to put people in housing and keep them housed as a result of that. So that is really the essence of. You move people into housing, and with a very high percentage will stay in housing with the right support services. So I thought of Miles Pendry in the lead up to talking here today, and I thought, like, wait a minute, I think that is a good framework to look at hunger. So hunger is bad. Enough food is good. Yeah, that's the essence of the solution, and there is enough food clearly in our nation, and at least at the last count, that may have changed a little from some of the environmental issues, but there was enough food throughout the world to feed everyone. You know, so that's the that's an essence of the problem, how we got there, and the how to go about in changing it. So I want to, in a few minutes remaining, and we're going to have a time for you to reflect. But I want to give you a couple of numbers and then share some personal things and then move from there. We have an ending homeless count in this community, and it is done throughout the world, I mean throughout the United States. We had ours at the end of January. It was 311. We have moved down from when our first count that we started was in 2002, and it was in the 800 range. Of that, 33 of them, which was down, 311 was the same as the previous year, but the count of 33 is the number that were living out on the streets. The other part of that number, the 280, were people who were in shelters in transitional housing. So they were sheltered, but they were homeless. Like the example that Sarah gave, that would be a person who would be counted in the homeless. She has no known address, but is not living on the street. So that's the numbers. But let me make it a little bigger picture of that. In London, when I came across this, it just gravitated to me. They call people who are homeless the rough sleepers. The rough sleepers. Well, England got, like the United States, very, very upset about this collectively. In fact, that there are many who say that Margaret Thatcher lost her tenure as prime minister as a result of this issue. Her secretary, the assistant, number two in command's wife, was so outraged about the increase in homelessness that she led a crusade on which many people said it toppled Margaret Thatcher's government. A recent account was 300 in the city of London. Now, this figure is not the same as the 33, because that's counting the rough sleepers are all people out there. So there's 300. In New York City, we have 52,000 that are homeless. 3,000 of them are on the streets. But even more dramatically, Los Angeles, the second largest homeless population in the United States, has 42,000. 42,000. 28,000 of them live on the streets. 186 times London's rate in population. I mean, LA is one half, but I did the math for that. So clearly, strategies do work. So that's the big picture. And we're moving to Sarah's chance for you to reflect, and then closing it down. I wanted to share some personal anecdotes about myself. And quite frankly, I had some difficulties with this. Even this morning, I had these stories about how I was going to have the stories, and Sarah gave the story of a personal face. But I wanted to share some of my own for the pot, because I felt it was important to connect about how my family has benefited from help. I was raised in the first couple of years of my life with my parents, my maternal grandparents, and my aunt Patsy. We were what's called doubled up. Doubled up is used in some of the homeless counts, not in Nashua, because some people double up, it's not a particular choice that they have. We then moved to the stadium housing projects in Lawrence. It was built for veterans. My parents were both World War II veterans. It was on a sliding fee scale. My parents' first rent was $25. That's what it was. I lived there till I was 14. My parents bought their only house, which they lived there until they died. It was bought by a VA loan. That's how we got help. Our son was born. We didn't have health insurance. We were college students, but it cut off in the summer. So we'd saved enough money. It was $100 for maternity, $300 for the hospital stay. I worked in the hospital where my son was born. I was an orderly in the emergency room, and the head nurse said, "You qualify for health insurance." I was real reluctant. I'm embarrassed. It was my responsibility to take care of that. So we got cared. So I feel blessed. But I also want to speak about what I think so often is the destructive mentality about interdependence, that somehow, how many here were born without somebody having a part of that? And whether you remember it or not, somebody cared for you. However it was, we don't get to this point in time. So my takeaway messages from that, whether it be on the government level or otherwise, that each and every one of us has vulnerability in the caring for each other. As Mother Teresa says, we all belong to each other. That's really the message. So Sarah is going to lead us in a meditation to sort of deepen our understanding. But thank you for all that has been done. Continue the work that we are. And we have made a difference in this community. And we can continue to make a difference. We are that kind of nation, we are that kind of community, and we are that kind of people here. It is the interdependent web in which we all belong. And Hillary and I feel so blessed to be part of this beloved community.
I actually feel that Bob has pretty much said everything that we need to say, but I'll just add a few couple things. When we were planning this service, I was thinking that I didn't have much personal experience about homelessness and hunger. And then as I was preparing for this, I realized I did have a few things. And I think everyone here in this room probably does have experiences or knows people who have experienced homelessness and hunger. So I'm asking you, as I talk, to be thinking of your own experiences. Maybe you can share with those at coffee hour with other people. I do know that when I lost a job, when I was a young mother and I was the main wage earner, my first thought was, we're going to be homeless. And I almost threw up. I was so scared. so I know how scary homelessness can be. My son experienced a devastating fire and lost everything. And I realized how frightened he was when he realized he didn't have a change of clothing, that he didn't have a toothbrush, that he didn't have anything that he, you know, when he went to get something, he didn't have it. It just wasn't there. He had nothing. And that was a scary experience for us all. In the reading that I've done, I see that one of the hardest things are the rules that are put on people who are homeless. You have to come in by this time, you can't have visitors, you can't own this, you have to have that. Your freedom is diminished. Your independence is diminished. You as a person is diminished. Also, how dependent you are on institutions and people for kindness. You have no choice. You have to ask. And that's a very hard thing. That's what I found when I was without a job for a while. It was very hard to say to people, I can't afford that. I can't do that. I can't. I remember our dentist, I told her, and said, he gave us free treatment because I said, I don't have a job. I don't have, you know, and it was hard to say that. So I hope you will keep these things in your heart. And I know you have many other things to share and add, your own experiences. And I hope that these things will inspire you to move forward in our work as a church and as people to make this a better place. Thank you.